welcome to another week of the Dynamic Duo Show right here on GCNLive.com. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett. I'm on here every Monday and Friday bracketing the weekend while co-host Jim Fetzer comes in for midweek duties starting tomorrow. And some of you may know I also have a new weekend show on the sister network WTPRN. It also features great GCN hosts like Alex Jones, Jack Blood, and, of course, myself. Every Saturday and Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, we inaugurated that this past weekend with David Ray Griffin, the Dean of 9/11 Studies, and a bunch of other great serious academic 9/11 researchers. And we got another serious 9/11 researcher on the line today. My guest today has been on my show twice before, I believe, but it's been a while. He wrote some very, very good articles about the 9/11 mystery plane, which he demonstrated to have been an E-4B flying Pentagon plane that was, for some reason, just flying over Washington, D.C. on 9/11. It's been proven to have been there. The military is all hush-hush. And my guest, Mark Gaffney, has done some more research on other aspects of 9/11, and he has produced a forthcoming book entitled The 9/11 Mystery Plane and the Vanishing of America, which is due out in September. Promises to be another great 9/11 truth book. I can't wait to get my hands on it. And I guess we do have our hands on Mark now, so let's bring him on. Welcome, Mark Gaffney. How are you?
Hello, Kevin. It's an honor to be here.
Hey, well, it's an honor to have you. We had some very good discussions, some of the best feedback I've gotten from people who were interested in the nuts and bolts of what went down on 9/11. It's from people who really appreciated your earlier appearances and the work you've done on this mystery plane.
Well, thank you. The research has evolved a long way since then, so we have a lot to talk about.
Okay, well, I guess we'll have to pick up where we left off at the beginning. When we left off about half a year ago or so, something like that. It's been a while. You had pretty well proven that this E-4B flying Pentagon was for some reason over Washington, D.C. on 9/11. And, in fact, the mainstream media ran something on that last September. What's the latest?
Well, do you think we should just review some of the basics for the listeners who aren't familiar with the story first?
I think we probably should.
Okay. Well, I believe this story began to percolate back in 2006 on a couple of internet boards, but I didn't hear about it until the spring of 2007 when I was contacted by an independent researcher based down in Pasadena, Pinnacle, Bob Pinnacle. And he, you know, led me to some evidence that I found incredible, and I began to, you know, research it myself, and we began to work together on it, and, you know, he'd feed me something, and I'd talk to him, back to him, and this thing kind of grew. And last summer, I posted a couple of articles on the internet about it, and I think we, had enough evidence at that point that we shamed, well, that's my interpretation, shamed CNN to, actually doing something on it, and last September 12th, they aired a short segment on this, and they had some footage of their own. We discovered it, I shouldn't say we, Pinnacle discovered it in the CNN archive where it had been gathering dust for 6 years. So we have a long video produced by raw footage from 9/11, filmed by a CNN cameraman, and this, you know, and I think that this discovery kind of, you know, the cat was out of the bag, or however you want to put it, and they actually aired a segment last September on it. So that was confirmation.
And that's one of the hidden good sides of what the mainstream media does on 9/11, with the BBC special on Building 7 from last month, for example. Many people were beating their brows, pulling their hair out about the distortions in that show. But, in fact, the BBC confirmed much of the basic knowledge of the demolition of Building 7. So now you can say, well, yeah, the BBC said that it you know, came straight down at free fall speed and so on and so forth. And the same, I think, is true when CNN admitted that this E-4B was flying around over D.C. on September 11th, and the military won't tell us why.
Yeah, that's right. The first reaction to, you know, a lot of people reacted negatively to my articles. They didn't think it was real. They thought we had, you know, touched the photos or, you know, something like that, or maybe the E-4B had been filmed on some other occasion. But no, this far-out story turned out to be true. So, you know.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. When I first had you on the show, there were a few people in 9/11 Truth who were kind of going slow and cautious and warning me and stuff. And, you know, once I had you on, though, I knew you were the real thing. And I'm really happy that it's really panned out.
Well, let me just give credit here where it's due. You know, I didn't do all the work on this. I wrote the book, but this could never have happened without the collaboration of some really excellent investigators who helped me. And Pinnacle was one. He's just an indefatigable researcher. You know, he's always coming up with stuff. And he has been he's really fertilized my imagination and creativity with a lot of the stuff that he has come up with. And there's another one who's going to be coming on the show later, John Farmer. Now, this is not the Farmer that was on the 9/11 Commission. It's a different Farmer. He's a process control engineer, and he was the individual who, on his own, produced the FOIA request that led to the release last October of the radar data from 9/11. So he's got all that on his computer, and it's just amazing what he can come up with. So he's going to come on the next hour and fill us in on some really breaking stuff that I'm not even fully aware of myself at this point.
Right, that'll be exciting. I just saw this radar readout that he's supposedly gotten, and it'll be interesting to hear him interpret what that all means.
Right, we're still analyzing this right now, you know, as we speak, and we're trying to, you know, get the latest in the book before it has to go to press. So we're kind of fighting a deadline.
Yeah, that's always tough. The 9/11 truth scene is, especially the research scene, is always changing and evolving. You've sort of brought us up to date, but tell us a little more about what is this E-4B that was flying around?
Well, this is the world's most advanced airplane. This is a flying Pentagon, like you said. It's a command and control plane. I mean, I really had no idea that it even existed until last year. It was complete news to me, but there's a fleet of four of them. They're based off at Air Force Base, the home of STRATCOM. Their job is to provide an alternative to the Pentagon in case of a nuclear war. The plane is designed, all the wiring in it has been hardened to protect it from electromagnetic pulse, which added a lot of weight to the plane, by the way, because everything, you know, they had to double wrap everything. And the plane is painted white to try to survive nuclear, you know, explosions to reflect away energy. And it has this communications pod behind the cockpit. It's a 747. It's a huge plane. Has this bubble behind the cockpit with satellite communications hardware. Can communicate with every military command worldwide, including submarines. And it can send the codes to launch missiles in the event of a nuclear war. So this thing is complete. It's a complete substitute for the Pentagon.
Well, that's amazing. A flying Pentagon was up there flying around over the ground-based Pentagon when that Pentagon was being attacked allegedly by a guy who couldn't fly a Cessna doing a stunt maneuver.
Really. Yes, and as we delved into it and learned more, the story gets more complex because it turns out there wasn't just one of these things over Washington. There were, like, possibly three.
Whoa, the whole fleet, almost.
Well, most of the fleet.
Three out of four.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Derrett, learning new things every day, and especially today from Mark Gaffney, the author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and the Vanishing of America, due out real soon. We shall return.
Radio. Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
Welcome back. Dean, please help me understand why there were a bunch of flying pentagons soaring over Washington, D.C. on September 11th when that extremely improbable attack on the Pentagon, well over an hour after apparent in-flight emergencies and hijackings had begun, half an hour, almost 45 minutes after the World Trade Center had been hit. There was still no air defense up, and the guy who couldn't fly a Cessna supposedly performed an amazing stunt maneuver that many pilots think they couldn't possibly accomplish in order to hit the side of the Pentagon that was newly reinforced, largely empty, and the furthest away from the top brass. This improbable tale becomes somewhat more understandable when we understand that there were flying pentagons soaring around overhead.
Yes,
Mark,
indeed.
I didn't know there was more than one.
Well, yes, and we'll talk about that as we go on, but let's touch on some of the other things first to lay the basis for that discussion. One of the criticisms, of course, you know, one of the normal reactions that people have is that this plane was simply was responding to the terrorist attack. You know, it was probably on some other mission, and then it was just rerouted over Washington. But there's no evidence that this plane ever helped in the NORAD response to the attacks. We know that the NORAD base up in Rome, New York, the NEADS, or Northeastern Sector Air Defense Center up there, was not able to communicate directly with the fighters over Washington. They couldn't because of the curvature of the earth. You know, their transmissions were not being read below 20,000 feet. So they needed to have a communications hub over Washington so they could actually communicate directly to their fighters. Well, we had this plane right over Washington, so it was, you know, the world's most advanced electronics plane. The question is, why did it not serve that function? We know later that an AWACS plane came in and did that, but that was much later. This plane was already on the scene and could have done that, but it didn't. The question is why, you know, and this is one of the questions we raise in the book.
Well, that's a very good question. It's the kind of thing you would want to ask some of our top Pentagon officials or then-Pentagon officials under oath. And they perhaps would be just as mendacious as they apparently were before the 9/11 Commission. Even the 9/11 commissioners are now telling us that our nation's top military commanders lied when they described these two totally different stories about the air defense response.
Yes, and we'll get into that as we go on. The radar data confirms that they covered up what actually happened. You know, there's no question about that. The real issue is, how do you interpret it, you know? Did somebody make a mistake, or, you know, was this something else going on?
Right. I guess I'm predisposed to suspect something else, but I'm always willing to listen to all sides.
Right. We have to consider all sides to it, but, you know, we have to ask these questions.
Indeed, and we need to get some answers, and we need to get some answers under oath, and we need a real investigation where these questions can get asked. And, of course, to get that, we need to convince enough people that there's a real reason to have one, and your work here would seem to suggest that there certainly is. So this E-4B was at least one, possibly two more were over D.C., yet they were not serving as relays for NEADS. But what else can you tell me about these planes?
Well, you know, one of the other responses that people give you is that, this is classified information, and that's why the Pentagon is tight-lipped about it. But when you probe this, it just doesn't pan out. Because what Pinnacle learned when he looked into it is that he's very familiar with the FOIA law, how the law is written, and he looked into the military regulations. And the Pentagon runs according to regulations, believe it or not, and the regulation is actually very similar to the FOIA law. So if somebody requests information from the military, like through their congressman, and it goes through channels, and that information is classified, their policy is to inform the congressman that, you know, this is classified information and we can't talk about it. That's the normal policy. But they didn't do that here. They simply denied the plane was there. So that's quite a different reaction.
So they're still stuck on their flat denial that this plane was ever there?
That seems to be the case. That's right.
Amazing. Well,
yeah, in spite of the evidence. And
right.
I should say at this point we have as many as 8 different videos. So the evidence has continued to grow.
And then there's a snapshot too, isn't there?
That's right. And I want to talk about that. This is a good time to talk about my trip back to Washington. Let's do that.
Okay, so what happened there?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was to, you know, you mentioned this photograph by Linda Brookhart. She was in the, you know, right outside the White House when she took this picture. She kind of just looked straight up and caught a shot of this thing from underneath, from below, and that is going to be on the cover of the book. It's an amazing photograph. And Pinnacle, in fact, was able to identify the plane simply on the basis of this one photo, which is pretty phenomenal. And he turned out to be right. But what I wanted to do when I went back to Washington was to try to pinpoint that spot where she was actually standing.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, because of the photograph shows part of a building, I was able to do that because the photograph, the building has very distinctive architecture. And there really is only one building like that anywhere near the White House. And I was able to find it. So we were able to actually pinpoint her location about one block from the White House and, you know, how she was standing and oriented. And it turns out we can pinpoint the location of the plane in the air, which is very important because when we get into the discussion about the radar data.
Great. So that's definitely an advance over where we last talked. So yeah, give me a sense of what do we now know about where this plane or these planes were precisely?
Well, this plane is almost exactly over the White House. I mean, almost literally came right over it. And this is consistent with the CNN footage, which also shows it kind of just after it had come over, and you can see from the CNN cameraman was standing right there in front of the White House by Jackson Place, and you know he swept up with his camera, and then he zoomed up and caught it. So that is perfectly consistent with Linda's photo.
Wow. So have people made FOIA requests? I guess, as you said, they've just denied that it was there.
Right.
Have people requested logs, or there must be some sorts of records about what's going on with these planes?
Well, yeah, this is another thing that Pinnacle has been doing. He has a lot of FOIA requests, you know, in the works, and we have received, in the last month, we've had two releases of FAA documents. So we can talk about that as we go on. But, yeah, it's all relevant to, you know, documenting this.
Uh-huh.
The other reason I went back to Washington, though, was to interview a witness. Because last winter I was contacted by a woman who works at the Department of Energy. She's a well-known analyst. Her name is Rebecca McNerney. And she actually saw one of my articles on the Internet. And I guess when we come back, we'll get into that. Huh?
Okay, and find out what Rebecca had to say. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Mark Gaffney. He's the author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and The Vanishing of America. Some very amazing research has been done by him and his colleagues. We'll be talking some more about it when we get back in just a few moments. So stay with us.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Dynamic Duo Show, right here on GCNLive.com. Today we're talking about where the dollars the tax man collects from you have gone. Many of them have gone to build a fleet of flying Pentagons, E-4B, command and control planes. And it appears that at least one and possibly as many as three of them were flying around over Washington, D.C. on 9/11, and the Pentagon is lying and telling us that they were not. My guest today, Mark Gaffney, is probably the leading expert on that subject, along with his colleagues and fellow researchers. Mark, you were just talking about having gone to Washington, and you interviewed a witness named Rebecca McNerney.
Rebecca McNerney, that's right. She's an analyst at the Department of Energy, and her office on 9/11 was in L'Enfant Plaza, which is just south of the mall. And Rebecca was, of course, watching the TVs in horror like everyone else. And then when she heard about the Pentagon, when she got wind of that, she walked down the end of the hall, looked out the window, and saw the smoke there over the Pentagon. It had just happened. And then she walked back to her office on the north side of the building, and immediately this huge white plane came cruising east along the mall toward the Capitol. And she said it was only, it couldn't have been over 500 feet, you know, in altitude.
Wow.
And, yeah, she saw nothing on the news about this. She saw nothing, in fact, nothing on the internet, nothing in the newspapers or media or anything until she saw my article on the internet about it. I guess it was early 2007, and, she contacted me. And, she's convinced it was the same plane that, that flew over the White House. And I went back to Washington partly to interview her. And I did that. She was gracious enough to walk me through what she saw. So I went to the DOE and, you know, she took me through the offices, and that one office had an incredible view of the Pentagon. It was only about a mile away from there. And then, her office on the north side of the building had a more limited view shed because of the other large buildings in the area, but she got a glimpse of it. And, so that's just another piece of evidence, another witness.
And that places the plane at a lower altitude than the videos and photos that I know about do.
Well, yes, there's a little bit of ambiguity in some of the evidence, but, there's no doubt it was probably several thousand feet up at part of the time, and then, there's one view of this thing. It looks like it was low, but this actually confirms that. Because this thing was flying really low.
Okay, so you're collecting more and more evidence about this, and I'm curious about your assertion that there may have been as many as three of these planes there. How did you come to that?
Well, let's begin to talk about the radar data. Last October, the John Farmer acquired the RAID's radar data from 9/11 after a FOIA request. This is the same radar data that the National Transportation Safety Board had in 2002, and it's the same radar data that the 9/11 Commission had in 2003. We finally got our hands on it last year, and it was processed by the Air Force Radar Evaluation Squadron based at Hill Air Force Base in Utah. And we've been studying it ever since, and there were a number of significant departures, for example, from Andrews that we have been studying during the critical time frame, and we have the radar data on these planes, and we have been able to confirm that at least one of these other takeoffs from Andrews was an E-4B, and probably two were E-4Bs. We're pretty sure, we're absolutely certain about the first, probable about the second. And the first took off about 9:26 a.m., and the second one took off after the Pentagon strike at about 9:45 a.m. Now, here's the clincher, okay? The radar data for these planes doesn't go over shows no radar tracks over the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So neither of these planes flew over the White House.
So that leaves us with plane number three, the one that everybody saw over the White House.
That's right. Leaves us with a mystery. Get this, there is no radar track for this plane over the White House.
Interesting. How would we explain that? Are there these sightings and photographs and videos and no radar data?
Yeah, this is the question. I mean, this is why it is so important that we, you know, have all this video evidence, the press reports, the sightings of this plane, and the witnesses, and the photograph from Linda Rookhart, which, you know, confirmed without any question of a doubt that the plane was there, and yet it did not show up on radar. So this is the question that we have been, you know, we've been exploring, and as we get into the, you know, I'm not sure if we should talk about the, let me just get right into it, I guess. One of the most interesting things about the 9/11 could turn out to be the most interesting anomaly and most important anomaly is that there was a time lag in the radar data. This has not been widely known, but it was confirmed by NSTB and their National Transportation Safety Board in their study. It was confirmed by the 9/11 Commission, but it was never explained.
Now, what do you mean by
25-second time lag in the data?
What is a time lag in radar data?
Well, you know, like on television where they have a time lag so that if somebody says something on TV that's indiscreet, they can erase that or put a bleep in there?
Right.
Same thing. Same kind of lag.
Okay. Okay.
So this is the question: was the radar data altered? That's the question we've been exploring.
That's an interesting topic.
Yeah, it is.
It reminds me of my
co-host
professor's
really.
Speculation about video time lags, which I do not want to get into here.
Well, I'm certainly not adherent to that view that, the planes did not hit the World Trade Center or something like that because they used Photoshop or something. That's ridiculous in my opinion.
Yeah, I think I haven't seen anything convincing to lead me to think otherwise myself.
Yeah, I don't want to go there. That's just not even worth pursuing. And
Right. But you proved there's a time lag on the radar data, and the radar data is not showing something that was photographed and videotaped over the White House. That is interesting.
Well, this is not speculation about the time lag. I mean, this is confirmed. The question is, how do you explain it, and what does it mean? And this is what we're trying to do now. Farmer, in fact, has been shopping for electrical engineers that can help him explain this. He's an engineer himself, but he's kind of stumped by this question, how they did this. We're not absolutely certain. We cannot prove that the time lag was actually, introduced on the day of the attack as this thing was happening, or maybe it was, something that happened later when they processed the radar data. We cannot prove that it happened on 9/11, but I mean, it makes sense to me that it did. I mean, that's just the logical conclusion that I draw from all the evidence.
Well, you'd want to do a very strong chain of custody search on this radar data that apparently doesn't show something that was widely viewed and videotaped and photographed, and I guess that would be a key part of your chain of custody.
Absolutely. That would be another line of investigation that needs to be done.
Right.
Very important one.
Well, but, this really does sound like you've got a case that's all set to, to take to a commission.
I just don't understand why more people haven't, been demanding a new investigation.
Right. Well,
but hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah, some of us have been. My congressional campaign, of course, has that as a top priority issue. If people, if you don't believe me, check it out yourself at DerekForCongress.us. But I am surprised that more people aren't calling for one. My opponent in this congressional race, Ron Kind, the notorious pro-war, anti-constitution, so-called Democrat, actually got a copy of David Griffin's book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. I personally handed it to him back when that book came out. And
he hasn't done
anything.
Oh, okay.
We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Mark Gaffney, the author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and the Vanishing of America. And the second hour, we're going to be bringing on John Armour, who's been doing FOIA requests on this topic. So stay with us.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
To the Dynamic Duo Show right here on GCNLive.com. I'm talking today with Mark Gaffney, and we'll soon be bringing on a colleague of his who has been also working on the same topic, which is the alleged mystery plane. It's going to be John Farmer coming to join us in the second hour. So Mark,
Evan, before we start, could I give the listeners, tell them how they can get a copy of the book?
Oh, yeah, sure. I didn't know it was available yet.
Well, it can be pre-ordered at Amazon. It's already up there listed. Or they can call Trine Day Press. And let me give the number for the listeners. That's 1-800-556-2012.
Okay.
And either way will work.
Great.
I'm kind of proud, too, Kevin, because this is an all-Oregon show. I'm based here in Oregon, and the publisher is near Eugene. And David Ray Griffin did the foreword for the book, and he turns out to be from Hermiston. which is in Oregon.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's an all Oregon production here.
All right, well, go Oregon. So, what else do we need to know about this E4B? I mean, you already made a very good, succinct case that we obviously need an investigation of this. The military almost certainly is lying when they deny that this plane was where we've seen it was, where the photographs and videotapes have shown us it was. Is there anything else you're going to have to tack on here to fill in the picture?
Well, I don't speculate about the mission of the E-4B in the book, but, I don't think I need to. I think that's the job for a investigation. I think we have enough evidence on this issue and on many other issues that are 9/11 related. So many unexplained anomalies and so many so much evidence that conflicts with the official story on so many ways that only an investigation should have the authority to resolve some of these things.
Your book actually treats some of the other areas of evidence as well as the mystery plane, does it not?
That's correct. About the first third of the book is on the mystery plane, and I take the reader right up through everything we know, and we just have to leave it where it is at the moment.
Okay, yeah, the extract I saw, which was published at Wayne Madsen Reports, was a kind of a compilation of many of these areas where we have reason to believe that the story we've been told is not true.
Yes, and if I may say, I think that I want to emphasize, I think, the importance of Abel Danger in this whole picture. I don't think it has gotten near enough attention. I think it's another issue that needs more emphasis. The testimony of Colonel Schaefer rings true to me, and this thing has just been kind of gone away, It kind of dropped into a memory hole, even since 2005.
That's a good point. For the listeners who don't remember this or who had never heard it in the first place, of course, was it Lieutenant Anthony Schaefer had been working with a counterterror program called Able Danger, and they had been tracking terror suspects, including Muhammad Atta, but then he was told by higher-ups to put a yellow sticky pad, a sticky paper thing, over Atta's face and some of these other hijackers, and to forget that he had ever seen or heard of them.
That's right. They were on to using this data mining. This was a legitimate counterterrorism operation, in my opinion. It was small but extremely high tech, and they were using very powerful search engines. They were claimed they were on to Muhammad Atta, or however you pronounce it, by February of 2000. I mean, way early. And yet they were ordered to destroy all their data that spring. That's very, very early.
And that summer, a huge amount of data.
Yes, huge amount of data. And that summer, Schaefer and a couple of his colleagues at Able Danger tried to contact the FBI to warn them about Atta. And those meetings were canceled by high-level Pentagon attorneys for reasons that have never been, the reasons they gave are ridiculous. And so we don't know why they did it, but it's very, very suspicious in my opinion.
Well, I agree. I was just talking with Jay Kolar yesterday on my show on We the People. That show runs on weekends 2 to 4 p.m. And he came on after David Ray Griffin yesterday. And he's written this great article on what we know about the alleged hijackers in that new book edited by Zaremka. And Jay Kolar paints a picture of these alleged hijackers that really it adds up to show that they were manipulated patsies who had doubles. Some intelligence agency was running doubles of these guys. In some cases, these doubles didn't even look like them. In fact, the overall take on this, these patsies who were by no means Muslim, they were party animals, coke snorters, drinkers, wouldn't go near a mosque or a prayer. If you look at the big picture that emerges from Kolar's article and Hofstetter's work and so on, it's just stunning that the people who set up these patsies must have been the Keystone Cops. I mean, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And, of course, Abel Danger, the honest guys, are out there wondering what the heck's going on.
Right, and Schaefer's career was over. His career was destroyed because he tried to do the right thing.
Right. It's amazing. All the the people who tried to do the right thing ended up out of a job or who knows, maybe worse. And these biggest screw ups, the people that did what apparently are horrendous mistakes, if you believe the official story, that allowed thousands of Americans to be killed. Those are the people who got promoted and got awarded, and it's all very strange and upside down, and you know, the red flags are so many, you just can't keep up with them.
Yes, and this is why we have to push very hard for the, you know, these FOIA requests are so important, to get our hands on real documentation. Because just, you know, having an opinion about something isn't going to do anything. We have to come up with real evidence. And that is where I think this radar data is going to help us, because it proves that the Pentagon and the 9/11 Commission covered up the NORAD response to the attack, so-called attack.
And once you
no
can,
question about it.
Right. Once you can prove that they're lying, and of course we've already proved that they're lying about these two wildly different versions that they gave to the 9/11 Commission. The first version they told to the 9/11 Commission was the one where these planes had launched and headed for Washington, headed for New York, and got there just a hair too late. But of course,
right,
that would have meant that they were flying very slowly to have gotten there too late. And that was the established version for a couple of years. And then they changed their story completely in the middle of the 9/11 Commission hearings and told a completely different story.
That's
so
right.
Clearly they were lying when they told one of those two stories, or perhaps both. And you add that up with this lying about the E-4B mystery plane, and you've
right,
got a pretty strong case that the Pentagon has been lying through its teeth about what was going on 9/11.
Well, the first part of my book is an overview of the official story, so that, you know, of the and a critique, so that readers who are not familiar with, who haven't done a lot of reading, or, you know, haven't read all of David Ray Griffin's books, or don't, you know, the other books, can get a synopsis of it. And then it leads right naturally into the sighting over the White House, because the call made by Colin Scoggins at 9:36, you will remember, was a plane 6 miles southeast of the White House. Well, if you look at the map, that plane was over Maryland. I mean, it, you know, because the Potomac River is directly south of the White House, so it had to be over Maryland. And there's no way that was Flight 77, because Flight 77 never crossed the Potomac. So what were they looking on their radar screens at 9:36?
Right.
There were planes in the sky over Washington that you know, were, that nobody, you know, this was never covered in any of the, after 24 hours, the first day, there was media coverage, and then after that, it disappeared.
And then they kind of tried to telescope it all into the plane that people saw over D.C. must have been that hijacked jetliner.
There were plenty of stories, yeah, that Flight 77 had actually flown over the White House, that it flew over the Capitol. And, of course, these stories were wrong. The CNN had the evidence in its archives all along that could have helped clarify what happened. But, you know, that's another issue. Why did they sit on it?
Well, that's right. And that adds to the suspicion of some form of mainstream media complicity in this.
Some form of it, yeah. It's hard to it's kind of a difficult issue to unravel. But I think there is a case there that some sort of collusion happened on some level.
Which, of course, isn't very surprising, knowing what we know. All right, well, we will be back in the next hour. Mark, you're going to stick around, aren't you?
That's right.
Okay, we'll be back with Mark Gaffney. And we'll also be bringing on a new guest. It's going to be, his name, John Farmer. John Farmer, who has been working with Mark, lodging FOIA requests to learn more about this E-4B flying Pentagon that was over the White House on 9/11 and that the military denies exists. Oh, boy. The more I learn, the crazier it gets. This is Kevin Barrett right here on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back after the news. So hang in there. Welcome back. Second half of today's edition of the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today I'm talking about the E-4B mystery plane, the Offutt Air Force Base-based, EMF-hardened, white-painted to reflect nuclear flashes, 747, with a bubble behind the cockpit connecting that plane to the entire U.S. military. These are called Flying Pentagons. And one and maybe three of them were flying around over the White House in the area of the strike on the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. My first hour guest, Mark Gaffney, remains on the line. And we are joined now by John Farmer, a colleague of Mark's who's been doing research on this mystery plane question, has fired some or fired off some FOIA requests and gotten some interesting answers. So, hey, welcome, John. How are you?
Oh, how you doing, Stephanie?
I'm doing well. We're having a great conversation, and I appreciate your coming on to add to it.
Well, we had some late breaking, so all weekend been working with some radar data that came out of the Reagan National Airport. And, matter of fact, I had to take a nap, so I missed the first half of the show, so I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I think you're probably going to get to break some of this. We kind of went over the basics, but what's the latest on the radar data that you've gotten from Reagan National?
Well, latest on it right now, I've only got about 90 seconds worth. The software is on a CD, which is in somebody else's possession. He just sent me the text file data, and I've had to parse all that out, Excel, et cetera. But the 90 seconds worth, there's some interesting things, some things I'm not ready to talk about yet. Robin Horton, he's going over some things as well. Probably the biggest is that last year, using the 84 RAIDS radar data, we were able to determine that about 6 seconds of the flight data recorder of AL-77 was missing. And we've confirmed that now with the DCA data. It has it still airborne. I think it's 37, 47. And, of course, by the flight data recorder, it's crashed at 44 seconds. So, in other words, after the flight data recorder says, you know, it's crashed, it's still in the air. So... We have to pursue that a little. I'm sorry.
I understand the flight path of the alleged black box data of AL-77 is likewise kind of mysterious. According to pilots for 9/11 Truth, it appears to be overflying the Pentagon rather than going straight into it.
Well, that's an illusion because they did cut off about 6 seconds worth of data. So when they cut it off, if you assume that that's 1 second before impact, it's way too high. However, when you match all that up with the radar data, what you find out is they cut off the data 6 minutes before impact. So
Six seconds.
So that's still back towards the Sheridan, and it's still up relatively high. So that would definitely, you know, give the illusion that it's flying over the Pentagon. But, you know, again, whether it be the animation from the NTSB or the flight data recorder, it's been tampered with, so it's really hard to say. What we've been able to establish with radar data is that definitely the flight data recorder has been tampered with. So that's another issue I'm going to be in court with the NTSB about. So
that's another issue where we've got the government caught lying through its teeth red-handed once again.
Yeah. Well, it's a question of which you want to take. You want to take the – and I haven't had time enough to work with the FAA data to say really anything about it. So is the FAA radar data, is the Air Force radar data, or – they lying, or is the flight data recorder lying, or, you know, which one's,
uh-huh.
You still know what I'm saying. Any way you go with it, somebody's got to answer something.
So well, that's actually an interesting parallel to the situation regarding the three totally different stories the military told about the lack of military fighter jet response on 9/11. The three were completely incompatible. Two of them were told to the 9/11 Commission, and therefore... they must have been lying at some point, if not at all points. And likewise, here it appears that some of this data that they're giving us must be false or tampered with, if not all of it.
Well, it's...
John, what about
the timeline? It's going to get even more complicated because I just got an email from the FAA today because I sent them a copy of a court order. And they decided to send off today, or at least they said they did, the audio recordings from Dulles, Reagan, and the Washington ARTCC. So we're going to be able now to be able to match what the controllers are doing with all the other radar data and other information we have. So the next few months are going to be pretty exciting.
That's right, yeah. Do you think you'll be able to piece together a reasonable hypothesis about what was going on, kind of a big picture overview of what was happening in D.C.?
Ultimately, yeah. I think ultimately we're going to be able to put together, we're going to be able to look and show where there's any holes, where something's been tampered with. It's called comparative data analysis. That's what I've already been doing with the RAIDS data and the flight data recorder. And you put that data side by side, and you know, there's some statistical methods you can use. But it'll show you where holes are, where things have been tampered with, because it's just like with the flight path. If you've got the FAA data saying this, you got the RAIDS data saying this, you got the flight data recorder saying this, you can pretty much look at it and say, well, something's been played with here.
Right.
Okay. And to some extent, you can reverse back from that and say what that is. But we're just going to have to see.
Right. Of course, the only way to really find out what it is to line up all these people under oath and start, you know, offering immunity from prosecution to some of them and you know, do a real investigation along those lines.
Yes, and time is our enemy. The farther out you get, the more clouded. I think Mark ran into some of the witnesses that over time, you know, memories degrade and
right.
it just gets tougher. You know, time is really of the essence. So I'm hoping we do find something significant within the next year. And all the stuff that's coming out now, that's really going to force the issue.
You think you might find something that's even more of a smoking gun than what you already got?
Well, the downside to the stuff that I do is so technical that
right.
And most people look at it and just go, okay, that's interesting, but I really have no idea what he's talking about.
Well, I hate to admit it, but that's my reaction when I looked at the email with this latest radar data.
yeah. So that's where people like Mark Gaffney, who has kind of a knack of putting that into more layman's terms, so to speak, is really an asset. So, because he's been able to understand a lot of what I've presented to him, and bring it down to, you know, where the average Joe can, you know, put the pieces together and kind of see what's going on.
If we shake the tree, something will fall, hopefully.
Yeah.
Right. And this story is told in this upcoming book, The 9/11 Mystery Plane and the Vanishing of America. What do you think are the most significant things that you found from these FOIA requests, John?
Well, the data is coming so fast now. But I say that the biggie is no doubt, without a doubt, smoking gun, okay, if you want to call it that, that the NTSB or somebody played with the flight data recorder. Okay, that is proven beyond any shadow of a doubt. I mean, you can say somebody did something to the flight data recorder. Okay, they trimmed off 6 seconds worth of data. Here's some other things that don't match up. Something happens. Okay, especially when you get a file stamp on it that's a couple hours before they even supposedly found the flight data recorder. Okay, so.
Well, that's pretty interesting, and I wonder whether that would be a criminal act, whether we could try to get somebody charged or get a criminal investigation of tampering with evidence. We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Durrett on the Dynamic Duo Show right here at GCNLive.com, talking with Mark Gaffney and John Farmer about the mystery plane on 9/11.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Paperback writer of Truth Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie. And I'm talking with Mark Gaffney and John Farmer. Mark is the author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and The Vanishing of America. And John is a researcher who's contributed to the work behind that book. We're talking about the mystery plane that is the E-4B Flying Pentagon, of which one or more were over the Pentagon when it was attacked on September 11th, 2001. Now, this clearly was the crime of the century. I'm talking about 9/11 in its totality, and yet there has never been a criminal investigation. The anthrax attacks were used as an excuse by the Bush administration to shut down the FBI investigation, such as it was, of 9/11. And I'm wondering, John, whether you think that the fact that you've apparently proved that the flight data recorder, or the alleged data from the flight data recorder provided by the government for American Airlines Flight 77, the flight that they claim hit the Pentagon, is tampered with. Well, this would suggest that there was a crime. Tampering with evidence is a crime, especially if it's the crime of the century. How can we make this go somewhere in the courts?
Well, that's going to have to be a political process thing. And that's just, you know, where the truth movement's at now is just bringing enough and irrefutable stuff, solid stuff. Like Stephen Jones, I mean, he, some of his work, that's kind of technical. Most people don't understand it, but the bottom line is you can't dispute it. He found certain elements and materials from the Trade Center site, and you just can't debate that. I mean, it's there.
I agree completely. Stephen Jones' work has turned out to be extremely productive.
Yes, and we have, and it's kind of something similar with what I am doing, because it doesn't just stop there with the NTSB. What we also found in the raids data was something that we still haven't fully identified. Okay, and I've been consulting of recent with some pre-renowned engineers, but as at this point, don't really have an answer to this.
Talking about the time lag, John.
Exactly. What we've identified, it was identified. The NTSB explained it to the 9/11 Commission staff, and I have emails to this effect. That basically, it was the 25 second delay between the NORAD data for the NEED sector or Northeast Air Defense sector. That their radar data was off by 25 seconds. Okay. And it was never fully explained by the NTSB or by the 9/11 Commission. As a matter of fact, I don't recall that it was ever really addressed by the 9/11 Commission. Well, as I had a limited set of SEAS data, which is the Southeast Air Defense Sector, once you compare those data sets, you find out that there is indeed a time lag, but it's not as simple as a 25.3-second time delay. It depends on what time. It exhibits basically four different time delays, and those time delays kind of vary in unison, and then actually every 27 minutes, they jump about a tenth of a second. Okay. The best guess is that what you're looking at is large data processors. Okay, when you're handling a lot of data, you're manipulating a lot of data, you use multiple computers and multiple threads. Okay, that explains the four distinct time lags. The fact that they're jumping, that generally indicates a pause while there's you're taking the data that you processed out and moving in a new batch. So what it looks like is that as far as the needs data goes, there's some type of intermediary processing was done. Okay, that, in other words, this isn't real-time stuff. What they've given us has been sent through some kind of processor. And just pure speculation, they had war games going on that day in Needs. And perhaps this is the signature of the simulation computer that they were running to generate false targets or whatever. However, what it does do is no doubt that in the Needs, the capability of putting in or taking out targets or returns definitely existed and was being used on that for that data.
Creating, for instance, false blips on radar screens in real time, or substituting stuff afterwards that wasn't really there?
Either or. That's the key. Was this being done real time on 9/11, or was this something that was done to the data? This is the same data, by the way, that they sent to the FBI on the 13th of September. Okay, it's also the same data that they sent to the 9/11 Commission. Okay, because we have the cover letter that. And that they sent to the FBI with the data. We have, obviously, the emails where the 9/11 Commission is trying to understand this time lag. So was it introduced when they processed the data, okay, for the FBI? In other words, were they taking in stuff? You know what I'm saying, playing with the data? Because needs is unique in this, because SEEDS, the data I have from the SEEDS database, doesn't show this at all.
Southeastern Defense Sector.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that something was done. Something was done to the needs data. Let's put it that way. That is definitely different from how SEEDS was handled, or the way it's looking now, like the FAA data was handled. So this is something that needs to be fully explored. But for obvious reasons, if you've got this thing to brush it off like the NTSB did, it's just a 25-second delay. No, it's much more complex than that. I don't know if Mark has shown you a graph of the waveform from it.
You know, that might have been what he emailed me, but frankly,
no,
I
sent you a different one,
make
Kevin,
heads or tails of it.
I sent you
exactly. Well, here's the problem. I've been consulting with some guys who are electrical engineers and head of computing departments at local universities here, and they're scratching their heads. And, well, it looks like a multiprocessor process, but they don't know what it is. And that's been, like I said, so smart people are having a hard time with that one. Obviously, it's not normal. Obviously, it's some kind of a regular process working on the data. What's behind it? Your guess would probably be as good as mine.
Well, that's interesting.
However, don't you think if they're going to use... Now, this is the data, and this is the bad part about it. This is the data that they use to build all the NTSB radar studies, all the radar stuff that was scrutinized by the 9/11 Commission. I mean, everything was built on this. So if everything's built on this and it's got this little problem... Don't you think that's an avenue that really needed to be investigated further?
Well, I would sure say so. And once again, we've got, you know, yet more indications of destruction of evidence, cover-ups galore, lying from the government. And that's, it seems like the evidence for that is so overwhelming in so many different areas of 9/11 that it shouldn't be that hard to reopen the case on that basis. You know, not on the basis of us trying to prove that X, Y, or Z really happened, but just on a much easier basis of proving that they've been lying and tampering with evidence. Okay, we'll be back in a moment to pick up from there. This is Kevin Barrett right here on the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm talking with Mark Gaffney, author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and The Vanishing of America, and John Farmer, a researcher who's helping with that project.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Dynamic Duo Show right here at GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today we're talking about the 9/11 Mystery Plane and The Vanishing of America. That's the complete title of Mark Gaffney's book. It can be pre-ordered from Amazon right now. Just Google it out, 9/11 Mystery Plane and The Vanishing of America. Or people can call 800-556-2012 to order it. That's 800-556-2012. And you know, Mark and John, I was at the Media Reform Conference a month and a half ago or so, and I ran into Norman Solomon. He's one of these people who are often called left gatekeepers. He has attacked the 9/11 truth movement. And I asked him, you know, what he thought about 9/11, and he responded that he said the official story is a cover-up. We need a new investigation. He said it's a complete whitewash, or I think that was the word he used. And said thank you, you know, and that's all well and good. The thing is, though, that people like Norman Solomon, who may understand that it's a whitewash and we need a new investigation, are not very enthusiastic about actually doing anything to get that investigation. He also said that he said, I think we need to wait and come to our conclusions after we have an investigation. So that was his implied criticism of the 9/11 truth movement, which, of course, does have the slogan that 9/11 was an inside job. There's a bit of a contradiction here. If it's very simple to prove that the government has lied repeatedly and destroyed evidence, and it is a bit more complex to try to prove what exactly happened. On the other hand, if we don't discuss this overwhelming evidence that it was an inside job, then the urgency of the new investigation is less obvious, and people like Norman Solomon can claim that, of course it's a whitewash, of course we need to do an investigation, and then go about their lives and go their merry way and do absolutely nothing to get a new investigation, and in fact to impede the new investigation by bashing the 9/11 truth movement. So it's kind of a paradox. I don't know if you folks have any ideas about this, Mark, John, or any of my listeners, how we can address this.
Well, I think that just keep doing what we have been doing, what John and Pinnacle have been doing, and that is FOIAing official documents so we have evidence.
Okay, we need hard evidence, and official documents are one form of that. What do you think, John, about these contradictions between the official documents, such as the contradictions between the sets of radar data?
One of the things that what has been very effective and is not addressed enough in the truth movement, I don't believe, but if you have something like that going on, and we're now considering, and I personally, I don't have a hypothesis of what happened. I'm a data guy. I'm interested in going wherever the data goes. Okay. And I just get frustrated when the data's been tampered with. But one of the things that I have observed out there, and I'm sure it's going on, because it happened in the Vietnam War, it happened during the civil rights movement, and anytime you have the government involved in something like this, you have some folks that are really good at seeding confusion, misinformation, disinformation, and really keeping things stirred up. And I think that campaign's been very successful in painting the truth movement as a bunch of Looney Tunes. Helicopters with electronic beams shooting at the Trade Center, or just other just kind of things that are on face value, are just kind of Fruit Loop stuff. And that's where I know when I first got involved in this, I had a professional reputation to think about. And I'm definitely don't want to be over there with left wing guys because I'm a conservative. Okay. And these are fears that are out there in the general public. But I just decided on my own because I had a son going to Iraq and I wanted to look and just see, a lot of stuff going on. A lot of it's crazy, but, you know, is there anything truth about any of this stuff? So I thought, I'm just going to start a project and look at some of the stuff myself. But the first thing that started happening to me is I started getting labeled, you know, John's going a little wacko. He's becoming a conspiracy nut, okay, and what have you. I think the government has been successful in doing that. If you question what happened, then you're put off in this basket case category, okay, and that makes a lot of very capable people very reluctant to get involved. Now, how are you going to fight that? I think what Marty just said, you stay to the facts, because the more you get off into trying to prove this theory or that theory or whatever, the more you get spun into that basket case category. And if you're wanting folks to take you seriously and what you're having to say seriously, stick with the facts.
Well, that sounds good to me. On the other hand, after having studied it sort of from a generalist perspective, looking at, the various evidence or the cumulative case that David Ray Griffin presents and has been presenting for several years now, that did convince me pretty early on that this was some sort of false flag inside job. And I think it actually is helpful to say that, even if it does play into the demonization of the 9/11 truth movement as crazy conspiracy theorists. At the same time, if you don't know, if you feel like you can never really know something that in fact you should know, it can be equally paralyzing. And that's discussed in some work on the Kennedy assassination. There's particularly a book by the psychologist Marty Schatz. Actually, he's a psychiatrist.
Yes, I've read that.
Right, and he points out that what can possibly be going on when it was obvious on November 23rd, 1963, to Fidel Castro and to any other truly informed observer that hardliners in the CIA and the military-industrial complex had killed the president in part as a coup d'état. This was an obvious, simple, straightforward coup d'état that was blatant the day after, and Fidel Castro basically told the Cuban people that.
There's a new book now on the JFK assassination, JFK and the Unspeakable, that I'm reading right now by James Douglas, that is just outstanding on this, has a huge amount of evidence in it. So what I'm trying to do with the 9/11 mystery plane is kind of walk a fine line between the two. You know, I want to stay grounded in the facts, and I give the people as much as they can, as I think they can take, and you know, in you don't want to overload people because then you lose your reader. On the other hand, I want to try and and give them a context also, and maybe try to keep in sight of the big picture. So that's what I'm trying to do in this book.
Well, I think the more hard evidence that you're able to uncover through original research, the better. That's a maybe the biggest contribution anybody can make, and it's great that you guys are doing that, and that John, you're getting these FOIA requests, and you know, getting this this hard evidence, because we the more of that we have, the better. But there is a certain point where you say, well, you know, we really kind of have enough of it now, it's just inconceivable that we haven't had a real investigation of this.
Well, I agree. I mean, you know, people are going to make, you know, speculate. And it's just, all I'm saying is we have to be aware that there is a disinformation campaign to try to destroy credibility of the truth movement. I mean, that was going on during the Vietnam War with the peace activists that was going on. I mean, that's all established history now. Okay, but you can see the same thing going on now, okay, with the truth movement. And I think that's something we all need to be cognizant of. And hypotheses based on facts are good things, okay? If you have a hypothesis that's built on, you know, good solid evidence, and that hey, let's debate that, okay? But let's just make sure when we come to the table that we have the foundation laid.
Well, that's a great point, and I agree completely. We'll be back to pick it up from there in just a few moments. I'm Kevin Darrett. I'm talking with Mark Gaffney and John Farmer. We're working on the question of the E-4B, or E-4Bs, flying Pentagons over D.C. on 9/11. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all you see. It's healing hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm on every Monday and Friday here at GCNLive.com. Co-host Jim Fetzer comes on Tuesdays through Thursdays. And today I'm talking with Mark Gaffney, the author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and the Vanishing of America, and a researcher on the same topic, John Farmer. And we were just talking about the need to stick with good data and reasonable hypotheses about 9/11. I just had David Griffin on the show yesterday. He said he thought that the more controversial evidence where there's no consensus in the 9/11 truth movement should be left for private conversations between members of the 9/11 truth movement and not put forward in public. Do you think is that a good way to deal with the problem of potential disinformation and non-fact-based theories?
John?
Well, for me? Okay.
Yeah, sure. I guess that's
Oh, John. Sure. I mean, that sounds reasonable. I think at the same time, you know, you don't want to stifle debate. You don't want to stifle free expression. Some wacky ideas can turn out to be not so wacky after a while.
Control.
Give you an example: the guys at the Citizens Investigation Team guys. Okay,
right.
They have been doing some outstanding work documenting a lot of the witnesses around the Pentagon. Okay, I mean they've been doing some outstanding work. I mean, great kudos. Unfortunately, you know, my issue with them is that they put a spin on it. Okay, the raw research is outstanding. I mean, it's great, and they've done a wonderful service. However, you know, there's some very controversial aspects to their spin, and that's created a lot of dissent among folks that are research in the Pentagon. Now, at the same time, we shouldn't discourage them from having their spin, because it definitely opens up the debate, and there's probably been more debate going on in the past year about their witness sets, et cetera, and in the end, they end up being right. I mean, I don't know. I personally don't know what happened.
Yeah, are you referring to their flyover hypothesis?
Yeah, that and, you know, some other things. But what I'm saying is that hypothesis itself and their activities has really generated debate, and I think that's a great thing within the movement, okay? And I don't know what happened, okay? I'll be honest with you. I mean, everything that I have looked at, I could not tell you now exactly what happened in those final seconds of flight, you know, American Airlines Flight 77. I mean, I don't know. And that is a problem. For me, that's the big problem. I don't know. I should know, because we went to war. Thousands of people have died. Billions, trillions, actually, dollars have been invested into fighting wars all because of this. And nobody can tell me what happened.
Right. Well, of course,
with any degree of certainty.
It would be irrational to have fought these wars because of this incident. If you stop and think about it, if this were what they told us it was, it would have meant that these alleged terrorists would have gotten incredibly lucky. And if you look in the big picture, you know, we've had not much over 3,000, if that, people killed by foreign terrorists, assuming that 9/11 was what they told us it was, for the past century. And that, you know, you crunch those numbers and you find out that's 2 days, you know, worth of cigarette fatalities and, you know, maybe 10 days at most worth of bad doctor treatment, or, you know, 29 days worth of highway deaths. It's in terms of the effect on the economy, there was a temporary blip, but it was actually, it did a huge favor to the city of New York by taking out those white elephant buildings. And in short, there's no evidence that there's a terrorist threat sufficient to completely, you know, retool society, roll back the Constitution, go to war against places like Afghanistan, where they offered to hand over bin Laden if they saw any evidence, or Iraq, where there was, you know, no evidence of any hostile intentions or WMDs. So any way you look at it, you can see that this whole thing has been completely manipulated, and the American people have been led into a so-called war on terror and these invasions of sovereign nations based on blatantly false pretenses, even if the official story of 9/11 were somehow true, which of course it wasn't.
Well, I see a parallel with the whole Vietnam experience. No convincing reason was ever given for the U.S. assault on Southeast Asia. And, you know, and there was never any accounting after that war. And I, you know, why we went there, you know, and trying to understand, basically it was just kind of glossed over. And I think that history tends to repeat itself when you don't understand, go to the deeper questions.
Of course, nobody died in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And if we let 9/11 go, then who knows what could be next. You know, I really feel like if the American people just roll over for this, you know, we're done for. What won't we roll over for?
We are gullible folks. I'm going to tell you, we're easy. They know how to play us. The folks that play these things know how to play us. And it's, I mean, I look back, say I'm a hawk. I'm a right-wing hawk, okay? And I was one of those that was all for, you know, go and get Saddam the whole nine yards, okay, until a couple of years ago when I started seeing, wait a minute, a lot of this stuff I've been told is just not right, you know. And
right.
But I can look back over the years before and see how I was played.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know.
Yeah. I think it's an old story. And, you know, you can really argue that war in general goes hand in hand with lies. Because, well, you go back to the beginning of war.
Truth is the first casualty.
Right. Truth is always the first casualty. And, you know, when they lined up these guys facing off against each other in these ancient civilizations, and the people in the back rows were pushing the people in the front rows together, and they were guaranteed to die with spears through their bellies. I mean, who would want to be on those front lines being, you know, crushed into that situation? Nobody would in their right minds. And so a different story has to be told to convince people that the natural warrior ethic and instinct, which is to go out and count coup and have a, you know, kind of have a battle in which you know, most people are not even going to be seriously injured, and, you know, you maybe touch the opponent and get away, and, you know, heroic exploits and bravery and all that. So that's what traditional cultures do for war all over the world. And this rationalized war of mass murder is something that nobody in their right mind would ever partake of, which is why the psychopaths who created civilization by creating war have been lying to us for the last 10,000 years. At least that's my take on it.
Well, I couldn't argue with that.
I guess that makes me not quite a right-wing hawk. I'm a moderate libertarian. Dove.
Well, all I can say is whether you're right-wing, or left-wing, Mark's book, I think it's a magnificent effort. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing it, and I really hope it'll get the audience it deserves. And you know, I suspect that the fact that CNN has legitimized this with their show last year could help it, you know, because we've got the mainstream media on record here supporting your basic thesis.
Well, I hope you're right. Absolutely.
And, you know, if I can think of any other ways to help promote this and get this out there, I certainly will.
Here's one little thing that I mean, one of the rare things that happens, okay, is he had 911 researchers such as myself, Robin Orton, and the staff at 84 raids in the military all agreeing on stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, this is a chapter on the radar analysis is going to anchor the book, Kevin. And this is the first discussion and analysis of this data that's, you know, ever appeared. There's nothing on the internet except for maybe what's on John's website. There's nothing else published that I know of.
Well, that's going to be a big breaking story. And, you know, maybe you should come back on for at least a brief touching base right when the book comes out so we can give it that little push. What date do you expect it to be actually shipped?
I'm not sure, but early September. That's the best I can give you.
Okay, that's coming up fast, and that's a good time to put out another solid volume of 9/11 research. Well, hey, thank you, Mark Gaffney and John Farmer. It's been a great conversation, and I urge you to keep up the great work in discovering what's really going on in terms of the mystery plane over Washington, D.C. on September 11th, and in general, the attack on the Pentagon.
An honor to be here. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, thanks, Mark.
Okay, take care, guys.
Thank you, John.
Bye-bye. This is Kevin Barrett on the web at barrettforcongress.us. We'll be back with more great guests Friday at Kirkpatrick Sale, talking about secession from the USA. And then on Monday, it'll be Bruce Schofield on the Mayan calendar. So check out the radio schedule at barrettforcongress.us.